AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. WalkingPost.com is the news website dedicated to walking, aka hiking, with all the latest on walks, trails, festivals, gear, books, and more. This week's podcast is airing on Friday, April the 18th. The rain did finally come here in Scotland, but enough said about that. I was able to get a bit of filming done in the beautiful coastal village of Currys, which isn't pronounced the way it looks, which is definitely the case for many places. In fact, everywhere that I've ever lived, there have been some very odd pronunciations of place names that let you know who the locals are. I shouldn't laugh, but it's always amusing when you hear a place that you know is being pronounced wrong. I have lots of stories. Maybe another time. We also did some filming near the River Tay, which included sending up a drone. And drones have become a bit of a talking point in the village I live in, as someone has been sending drones up a lot and filming. And a few of the locals are not amused. I did buy another small camera this week for filming, as if I didn't have enough already. It's a bit like when I played in a band and every week there'd be a new cymbal or percussion instrument in the house. Well, because you can just never have enough. Last week on the podcast we talked about a festival in Wales, and we also talked about the upcoming Extex Trail being planned in Texas. I think that's definitely going to be an iconic trail. This week we have an interview about another relatively new trail, and that's the Argyle Ross Trail in Hong Kong. It's not in Argyle, nor is it in Ross. And we also have a feature on the Haltwhistle Walking Festival. As I mention every week, and I'm going to again, you can reach out with news, guest ideas and comments via walkingpost.com. Or you can just email me, jim@walkingpost.com. And as always, before we get to the interviews, let's take a brief look at some of the headlines of the news articles we had on walkingpost.com this past week. A new nature trail has opened near Tamworth. Northern Trains customers are getting access to some of Komoot's walks along their train routes, and a European Green Belt hiking trail is being planned. And a clue about that one, it's very long. East Cheshire Council has set its sights on creating a major new trail, and the Winchester Walking Festival is set to return in June. The Lynx Smart Ring has been launched, and it does look quite interesting. What will they think of next? Maybe smart earrings, or maybe smart socks that walk themselves. The University of Cumbria has hosted the launch of the Wordsworth Way Trail, and you can read all of these articles and many more at walkingpost.com. Okay, time for this week's interviews. This week we're featuring another walking festival here on the podcast because it's a great way to get the message out about walking in different places. One part of the UK that seems to be somewhat overlooked and definitely shouldn't be is Northumberland. It's got so much to offer. It's got beaches, forests, hills, islands, history. And then there are parks, Hadrian's Wall and the Pennine Way, which makes the Haltwhistle Walking Festival such an attractive event. Katrina Mulligan, one of the festival organisers, can fill us in on all the details. All right, thanks so much for being with us to tell us about the festival. But first, maybe you could tell us a bit about Haltwhistle.
Well, Haltwhistle is an unusual place. It's a very small town, this little market town. It's very close to the border with Cumbria, and it's about 25 miles from Newcastle, which is obviously the regional city. And it's in a unique position in that it is a gateway both to a World Heritage Site, Hadrian's Wall World Heritage Site, and Northumberland National Park. They're both to the north. And then to the south, you have access to the North Pennines National Landscape. So this little tiny market town is in pole position to welcome visitors and to introduce them to all the different, very special, on a world basis, on a national basis, our landscapes, our communities, our history and our wildlife.
Maybe can you tell me a bit about the history of the festival, you know, when it started and what it was like and for the first edition?
Sure. I wasn't around for that first edition, but I'm very familiar with its history. It came about as a response to Foot and Mouth. Foot and Mouth broke out in 2001. It actually started very, very close to Haltwhistle, and it ravaged the rural community. As you probably know, the access was shut down. And although that lasted a very long time, the impact actually lasted for a great deal longer. A little bit like COVID, actually. Anyway, Haltwhistle is a very intrepid place. And half a dozen guys decided, once the restrictions allowed one or two people out, they decided to get out and about, and they started trying to walk the footpaths of Haltwhistle. And they soon realised that they'd better do some practical work themselves to get the stiles in order and the footpaths in order. So they did a lot of practical work, and, you know, we're benefiting still from the legacy of that. And that then grew to the idea that they'd publish some circular walks. There's 22 of them, and they're called the Haltwhistle Rings because they're circular walks. And from that, someone decided that they ought to have a walking festival. They had two a year for many, many years. We now only have one a year, but the festival is celebrating its 23rd anniversary this year. So it's one of the longest running festivals in the country. And it is entirely generated by local enthusiasm. Many walking festivals, as you know, get funding and get resources from their local authority, you know, particularly the marketing, managing a website and the marketing of the festival. The walks are usually led always by volunteers, but we don't get any of that support here. The Haltwhistle Walking Festival does it all itself. It manages its own website. We manage our own volunteers, and we have a team of nearly 40 volunteers on each festival. It's quite a phenomena. But the reason why there is so much interest, I mean, it's not difficult to get walk leaders. We have three people on a team. We have a leader and two backups always. And the reason for that is that the entire group walk together each week. We haven't got any formal constitution for our Wednesday walks. We're just a group of friends. The festival, of course, because we take money and we take people, it is registered as a charity and as a limited company. But that, in my view, is the reason why there is so much support for the festival. It's not difficult getting leaders. And it goes back to that history. So good old Foot and Mouth. Some good came of it.
Do you get lots of people that are local, or you mentioned that Newcastle is your kind of major hub? Are there a lot of people? Where do people come from for the festival, I guess?
Yeah, we do get a lot of local people coming back and back, and we get a lot of people from the region, Newcastle being our sort of big city, and Durham as well, just to the south. We certainly get folk down from Scotland too. We have people from Wales. Our next biggest group, though, is probably both Yorkshire and the southeast London. And we're always very surprised, perhaps we shouldn't be, by how many folk we do get from the southeast. In fact, we had a group a couple of years ago with an address of WC1. I mean, they were right in the middle. And of course, everybody is blown away by the countryside, by Northumberland. There are very few visitors here. They all go to the lakes or they go to Scotland. They come up the M6. The A1 is not really recommended for travelling in many people's views if they've got a choice of the M6. So Northumberland is a hidden secret. And we do get people, as I say, from all over the country. We even get people from abroad. We had a guy that we called, we nicknamed Chicago George, who came for about 5 years. And he worked for the aviation industry in Chicago. And he came over here and he got off the Hadrian's Wall bus in Haltwhistle and went into the Working Man's Club and picked up the leaflet for the festival. And he was in festival week. So he came and he came back for 5 years. So he was our furthest away visitor at about 3,800 miles. But it was capped last year by three or four women from Australia. One of them had some relatives over here. They were planning to come, but they also picked up our publicity in Australia and planned their holiday around it. They hired a house in Gilsland and took part in almost every day. And if they didn't walk, they always met us in the pub in the evening as the walk came in. So, yeah, we're international, we are.
I know it's the I did an interview with the folks that run the Pennine Way. And of course, it's their anniversary this year. Are you doing anything to coincide with that?
Yeah, it's the 60th anniversary of the Pennine Way. And our walk programme always has a 3-day linear walk over the last weekend, which is the May Bank holiday, the first May Bank holiday. So this year, of course, we're dedicating it to the Pennine Way. And we're doing 3 days. We're starting in Bellingham, which is to the north of Hadrian's Wall, and everyone will be walking south. They'll be hitting Hadrian's Wall and walking along it, and then walking south through the North Pennines landscape area, and then ending up back in Haltwhistle for the last day of the festival. So, yeah, I know we're very much celebrating that centenary. And of course, I am very delighted to be involved with it because I walked the Pennine Way over the holiday when you leave school before you go to university. There were five of us. And at that time, I have to say, that would be 1971, there were hardly any signposts. And we would have been using 1-inch maps. And how we did it, I have got absolutely no idea. Where we were, I occasionally see places and think, yeah, I've been here before. But we had a great time. So I've walked all of it, and I've walked an awful lot of the northern bits over my time here, both professionally working and in my recreation, which didn't vary too much from my professional job. It's a great walk, as long as the weather's good. And the whole philosophy of the Pennine Way was tough. You know, it had to be tough. It's not like all the long distance routes now. Our one, the Coast to Coast, was designed, or at least one of our local ones, from Lake District through to the North Yorkshire Moors to go through three national parks, but also to go through a village at lunchtime and a village with a pub in the evening so that you could stay and spend money in the local community. But the Pennine Way has taken off recently with these spine races, you know, these fell runs that they do. And it's ideal for that because it is very remote. And if you want to run 246 miles in about, I think he did it in about 4 days, then the Pennine Way is perfect.
Is there anything else in store for the 25 version of the Haltwhistle Festival?
Well, we have 3 walks each day, and we tend to divide them into a shorter walk, which might be anything from 5 miles to 8 miles. All of them have themes that develop the history or the archaeology or the natural history, the landscape. So we've got a short walk each day. We've got a longer walk, and these are circular walks. And we also have about 6 special interest walks. And on the special interest walks, we have a leader that is specialist in the subject. For example, we've got a local geologist leading a walk called Hadrian's Wall Rocks. So he's looking at the geology of the wall. We've got another leader who is a very keen wildflower specialist and photographer, and she is leading a wildflower photography walk. We've got a guy who is the most amazing bird watcher. He can listen and spot and all that sort of thing. And he's leading a bird watching walk. So we have a whole series of special interest walks as well, with a smaller number of people so that they can get more into whatever it is they're looking at.
Are there costs involved with each of the walks, and Can you take dogs?
We certainly do charge. We've got costs to cover. We don't aim to make a profit. We aim to cover our costs. We have no other costs other than the running of the festival. So our charges generally fall into two categories, £10 for an ordinary walk and £15 for a special interest walk. And then if we've got a bus involved as well, which we do on the Pennine Way, then we charge £20 if there's two bus rides, morning and evening, or £15 for a one-way bus. In other words, it delivers you out and you walk back to Haltwhistle. Dogs, definitely not. This is an upland area. We're right in the middle of lambing at the moment, and there is spring calving going on as well. So a decision was taken right from the very early days that the best solution is actually to say no dogs. Many dogs can be very well trained and will walk to heel, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But you can't guarantee that. And you can't guarantee what one dog owner's idea of a well-trained dog is, particularly when they see a sheep or a lamb or whatever. So, no, it's not an unusual thing around here for many of the upland walks to say no dogs. We like dogs, but they're just not allowed on our festival.
Right. And what about for the people you mentioned, Australia and Chicago and London? Is accommodation easy to find in the area?
Yes, it is. There's all of the local websites, Visit Northumberland. We put information on our website as well of any accommodation when people have contacted us. And many of them offer a discount if they're coming to the festival. So there's a whole range of accommodation here, from small pubs with rooms, bed and breakfasts, and small hotels. And there's a lot of self-catering accommodation as well, and that a couple of groups are staying in this year too. So we can advise on that, where they can get the information.
It seems like it's an amazing event. Do you usually get decent weather, or is it varied?
It does vary. We have had snow on occasion. Last year was the very wet year. It rained and rained and rained, and we had notices up on the website saying, you know, we always say boots and gaiters, and but you know, don't forget them. But folk enjoy it, whatever it is. You know, obviously it's a lot better if you can see. But we can have quite good fun in mist, and we can demonstrate our skills at navigation if you can't actually see on these featureless moors. But generally we get a range of conditions. It's been very dry this year. And of course, you know, the farmers are saying the grass isn't growing. That's a problem for them. Although the weather's likely to change and break, the long distance forecast, I don't know how accurate they are, but it is forecasting good weather for the festival. So we've got our fingers crossed. But everybody's enjoying the recces at the moment because the weather is just absolutely superb.
There's a website that people can book the walks on?
Yes, our website is Haltwhistle Walking Festival. .org, and all of the walks are up there, and it's very easy to see which still have spaces. We're absolutely delighted that there are 10 of our walks that are fully booked. The bookings went crazy just as soon as we opened, which was the 1st of March, and we had huge numbers of bookings on the first day that the festival opened. I think the weather has an impact on that. People are looking at the weather and think, well, I'll go walking. But also we're 5 years past Foot and Mouth. And Foot and Mouth, although it didn't feature on the TV after about the first 2 or 3 months, the impact of that on people was huge. And of course, COVID too. People are beginning, we think, to feel that they can get on a bus and travel on a coach and be in a group of people. And it's 5 years since COVID now. And we think that that's a turning point as well. So whether it's the weather, whether it's the 5 years, whether it's just the luck of the draw, but people seem to be in a very optimistic mood this year. Everybody's looking forward to the festival, including all of our leaders.
I'd definitely agree about that part of England being beautiful. The towns are nice and there's some stunning walking. Great people too. Next, we're going to somewhere a little more tropical, and that's Hong Kong. I think when most people think of Hong Kong, they think of a high-tech city with tons of tall buildings, and that's about it. However, there is so much more to it than that, including lots of trails. And now there's a new and very challenging one, thanks to two teachers from the UK who live there. Jack Argyle and Stuart Ross devised the trail, which starts on an island. And no, you don't get a ferry to the next one. You swim. But don't get any ideas about drying off, because each of the 12 stages includes getting wet. So let's talk about difficult hikes in Hong Kong. Stuart, you're from Scotland, where I live now. Tons of hiking opportunities. You must have grown up with this.
You know, my first 20 odd years in Scotland, never walked. When you're young, that's not really your first priority. And then moved to London, and I walked a bit in London, you know, just in the streets and stuff. But then it wasn't really until coming to Hong Kong, and just the trails in Hong Kong just being so accessible, and got up into the mountains, got up into the hills, and psychologically, it just did wonders for me. You know what? It's funny, because I'm from Scotland, which is known as a walking country, but it wasn't until coming to a big city like Hong Kong that I got into hiking. And
I think the weather helps as well, that's for sure.
True, it does. It's brutally hot for a lot of the time in Hong Kong, but generally the weather's great. But, you know, the trails here are so beautiful, so accessible as well. It's just dead easy to get out. Coming to sort of the Argyle Ross and how it came to that trail or that concept, you know, I was hiking in Hong Kong, hiking quite a lot. Every weekend I would get out in the trails, and then I did an injury, got a tear in my ligament. So it put me out of hiking for many months. And I kind of got a little bit depressed, Jim, you know, just sitting around in the house and not being able to get out. So I bought myself 5 countryside maps, OS maps of Hong Kong. And I would just sit there every night in my bed and just plot routes in my head, you know, and that's the only thing I could do to keep me sane, because I couldn't get out on the trails. You've got Hong Kong Island, which is quite well built up. But then beyond that, you've got the New Territories. And the New Territories is big. I don't know the square mile, but it's a big place. And I was looking at the Northeast New Territories, which is the far side of Hong Kong. And there are these 3 little islands, which are very close to the mainland of Hong Kong. And I was thinking to myself, you know, I was kind of plotting a little trail on this map. And I was thinking, you know, you could swim to this island, and then you could swim to this island, and then you could swim. It's only like a 100-meter swim, then a 200-meter swim. And it got me thinking about it. And then when I healed, I said to one of my friends at the time, I was like, here, I've got this idea. I'd looked it up on the internet. I hadn't seen anything about it. I don't think anyone had done this before. But I said to him, do you want to give it a go? And he was like, yeah, sure. We spent about a year planning this sort of trip around these 3 islands. And then the day before we were due to go out, you know, we bought all the kit, the dry bag, and because you have to swim light. You have to go light on this, because you're swimming in the sea as well as hiking. So you have to go light, you have to bring a hammock, very little food, you have to bring a water filter. So it's quite survivalist. So I'd been out into the swimming pools in Hong Kong to try and test the bag, to see how far I could swim with the bag. But I'm not a big, strong swimmer. So a day before going out on this trip around these 3 islands, I went and got my will written in Hong Kong. I didn't have a will. And I've got 2 kids and a wife. And I was like, do you know what? I don't know if I'm going to survive this. So I went and got my will written. And then the next day I went out and did these 3 islands. And it was unbelievable. It was so amazing. Like, Hong Kong is such a built up place. There's so many people. But I didn't see anyone for 2 days. It was just me, 2 other guys, swimming these islands, sleeping in a hammock, starting a fire, cooking some steak. Didn't have any data on the phone because it was so remote. And that's kind of how this trail sort of, you know, the Argyle Ross Trail started. And then Jack came to Hong Kong. We became friends. I took Jack out in some streams because we got to sort of hiking streams as well. So hiking up streams and jumping in waterfalls and things like that. And then I took him on this island, this 2-day kind of island swim hike. And you loved it, didn't you, Jack?
I mean, that was... Yeah, absolutely. So different. I mean, the islands out there, it's a bit like swimming around the Greek islands. And the fact that you're going from one to the other, it was like nothing I'd done before. We've done quite a lot of hiking all around the world and had started to in Hong Kong, but this is really different. And then with the streams as well, it was particularly good in the summer, the rainy season. And that means that the streams are full and lush. The waterfalls are quite strong. And obviously it's really hot. So it's so nice to jump in. And then also the sea is warm. You can just about swim all year round, but it's particularly nice from about April to November. So unlike every other trail in Hong Kong, which it's much better to hike during the cooler winter, the complete inverse. So that's another, makes it a little bit more unique.
There was one day we were going out on a stream and we started to link up streams. So you can hike up a stream and then you go over the top of a ridge and then there's another stream down the other side. And we kind of got into linking streams up. And we'd spend a whole day just sort of going up one stream, jumping in waterfalls, going down the next stream and just exploring and finding out all these little mini routes. And then there was one day we were doing two streams. It was actually up Hong Kong's highest mountain, Tai Mo Shan, and then down the other side. And then Jack said to me, if we link up these two streams with these streams and then these islands out here, we've actually got a long distance trail here. And that's kind of how the trail started, really. And then
Penny just dropped, didn't it? It's like, we've been doing these for the last few years, especially you. And like, why don't we just link it all together? And then as soon as that light bulb moment happened, we just got so excited and said, this could actually work. And then the next stage was, well, let's try and make this different. The long distance Hong Kong trails are divided into sections and they are usually very, very, the end, the start and end of each section is accessible to public transport. But we wanted to make each section have a water feature. So each of our 12 sections across the 100 kilometers has either a sea swim, a stream hike, a beach or waterfall, or often more than one, you know, three or four of those water features. So anytime you do any of the sections, you know you're going to be getting wet, really. You don't have to in a lot of them, but that's the whole point. That's part of the fun.
What about the lengths of them? How is it divided up into sections?
This is one of the things that took a long time. And when we first initially plotted out the route, which is basically goes as from the island, it's called Crooked Island, right in the far northeast of Hong Kong, right near the Shenzhen border. And it finishes sort of midway on the west. So it's coast to coast. So we had that sort of full length in mind. And then most people like to do these longer distance trails section by section. So you might do one section on a Saturday, then 2 months later, you might do two or three sections, depending on your fitness or your time constraints, things like that. So we wanted to basically use that same structure, if you like, or that same pattern. Public transport in Hong Kong is absolutely excellent, but you still need to, you don't want to finish a section in the middle of nowhere. As much as we could, I think with the only exception of maybe one or two sections, each section had to finish at, you know, either a bus stop or an MTR stop. So that was one of the things we did. And then once we started doing it, we had to change the length of the sections. Normally, they would be something that you want to do in half a day or a day. So it would probably be between 2 and 5 hours. And often they just felt like it was almost like a natural ending to a section, like maybe it was a particular landscape, maybe it was a particular stream, maybe it was the end of a national park, maybe it came to an urban area. So we had it sketched out, but then once we actually did the sort of the main recce and height of the whole thing, the sections fell more gradually into place.
We had conflicting ideas of what a good trail is. I love my through hiking, you know, I like hiking a section and then setting up camp, cooking some dinner, getting up early the next day, having a coffee and doing the next section and so on. So for me, each section kind of, it was important that it finished somewhere where we could like sling up a hammock and make camp for the night. Whereas Jack is more of a day hiker. So he enjoys a hike and then having a pint at the end, a nice meal. Also for me, you know, it's quite important when you're through hiking over several days, it's important to kind of have opportunities to resupply as well. So bringing it through urban areas where you can pick up some food or what have you. Whereas Jack likes to stop at finish at a pub and have an opportunity for a nice dinner. And I think we achieved a sort of balance.
Yeah, we got a balance.
Yeah, of that. There's loads of great spots to put up a hammock. I'm not going to say tent here because you can't do this with a tent. You know, you're going to be swimming in the sea. You can't do that with a tent. You have to go light. So it has to be a hammock. But also there's opportunities as well to, you know, at the end of section four, for instance, there's a great British pub, King's Belly, you know, where you can go in, you can have a curry or a pie and a pint in Hong Kong. You know, it's fantastic. At the end of another section, there's probably one of Hong Kong's best dim sum restaurants. It's al fresco. You can sit outside, you can help yourself to all this lovely dim sum. So, you know, with that experience of kind of knowing all these cheeky little places around Hong Kong, these kind of restaurants and stuff, we kind of made an effort, didn't we, Jack, to build that into the trail as well?
Absolutely. And and that's one of the some of the good feedback that we've had is that we've integrated probably, I would say, half of the sections finish or go via apart from the King's Belly, actually, it's all local Cantonese cuisine. And some of it is really, really good. There's a barbecue place. There's some dim sum. And we felt that's important because, you know, if you've got a day out, you want to try and have a nice meal on the way or when you finish. If you look at our website, we've got a trail report for each section. And when there is a good restaurant or a bar, we mention it. But more like a travel guide as well as just a hiking guide. And on top of that, we've also integrated some cultural things as well. So there's actually on our last section, section 12, there's a temple right up towards the top of one of the highest peaks called Castle Peak. And there's a temple and a very old monastery, which was actually featured in Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon. It's got some of the scenes there towards the start of the film. So those little things, those references, when we write about it, we'll add in a little bit of information, a bit of detail. There's some other temples along the way. So we're trying to not just do hiking. We're trying to bring in some cultural and elements and some cuisine as well. And just going back to what Stuart said about the hammocks, like, I've never been a massive camper. I quite like it, but this is very, very different. First of all, you're not carrying so much stuff. It's just a tiny hammock that scrolls up into your rucksack. And then there's, for me, especially in these warm summer months, first of all, again, it's easier to set up the hammock between the trees. And it's just a different feel than camping or sleeping on the floor. You feel, I don't know, how would you describe it, Stuart? It's just, if you feel, you're also cocooned in your mosquito net.
You feel like you're completely in nature, right? You're exposed to nature.
You're in the trees.
I absolutely love it. And I sleep really, really well in a hammock. But just this whole experience is just, and being in Hong Kong as well, is just, for me, it's opened up this discipline. It's a new discipline, I think, of trail design. And Hong Kong is perfect for it because there are so many cheeky little trails everywhere. It is a mad network of trails. Honestly, I don't think you can experience this sort of network of trails anywhere else in the world.
Certainly not in a major city. Absolutely
not. No, and they're absolutely everywhere. You can just walk out. No, it doesn't matter where you live in Hong Kong. You can walk out. You're on some sort of trail. There's an app called Hiking Trail HK where you can plot a route. And you've got so many options of where to go. So for me, it's really exciting just kind of thinking about all these kind of aspects that we think about in terms of, do we need to resupply here? How are we going to split this up into sections? How can we stop this at some public transport, a bus or an MTR station, so people can come in and out if they're doing it by sections? And all these little things, it's like a puzzle, right? You have to balance it to appeal to different types of people.
Did you get any input from tourist boards or local government, that kind of thing, or is it just all yourselves?
Not yet, actually. That's something that was certainly in our mind. We thought about contacting them. I would say one of the reasons we haven't at the moment is because it's quite a challenging route, and I suppose the sort of health and safety aspect of it, with swimming in the sea, with boat lanes and waterfalls that you hike, that you climb up, there's ropes that are already in there. I don't think the Hong Kong government would probably approve, probably a little bit too difficult. And we do put a disclaimer on our website, and certainly not for under 18s to do on their own. I mean, it's not really dangerous. I just don't think the government would go for it yet. Having said that, I read your article about the big promotion of hiking in Hong Kong, and it's such an asset to the city, to the region, the territory. We really want people to come, not just within Hong Kong, but from abroad. They've got 20, 30 million tourists come every year, and we'd love for them to hike our trail as much as the others. So as Stuart said, I mean, there's hundreds, probably thousands of miles or kilometers of trails, and most of them are marked. And then there's also these smaller sort of sub trails which connect to the major trails. We took some of those smaller trails as well and then linked them to the streams. There's one other thing also worth saying that a lot of people don't realize about Hong Kong is that it's 70% countryside and 40% is protected country park. So there's a huge amount to explore, and there's beautiful beaches, mountains, jungle forest, lots of rivers, waterfalls, varied landscapes as well that you wouldn't expect. So it really is a bit of a paradise, and it's a bit of a playground, an adult playground really for us.
I have a website called throughhikinghk.com. It's become one of the biggest kind of hiking websites in Hong Kong. People contact me all the time through this website, and this guy last year contacted me. He's actually from the Netherlands, but he spent some time in Hong Kong, many years in Hong Kong, and he designed a trail, and he called it the Northern Passage. It skirts the border of Shenzhen, so it's in Hong Kong, but it's right on the border of Shenzhen. And it's difficult to explain if you're not from Hong Kong what that means, but the north of Hong Kong is actually very rural. there's not a lot happening. There's kind of marshes and it's not particularly built up. And then you've got the border. And then all of a sudden there's this massive city, which is Shenzhen, which is the China side. And China have just started opening up the border more to foreign travelers and to Hong Kongers as well. And this guy, Wildrick, who designed this trail, sent me it. And it kind of skirts the border of Shenzhen the whole way. And it got me thinking, because the Hong Kong government are piling money into the north part of Hong Kong to kind of integrate it more into China. And they're creating this thing called the Northern Metropolis. So they're building tech hubs and apartment blocks and all sorts of stuff. And I thought, you know, this is a really cool trail in the north of Hong Kong that skirts Shenzhen. So I split it up into sections so that each section stopped at a port where you can cross into Shenzhen. So it's an 8-section trail. Go over to Shenzhen, stay in a nice cheap hotel, get your hot pot and so on. So it would promote Chinese mainlanders to come to Hong Kong and vice versa, which is exactly what the Hong Kong government are trying to do at the moment. So I would reiterate what Jack says, is that the Argyle Ross is just a bit too niche, a bit too tricky for kind of mainstream. We don't want to see hundreds of people out on the streams or swimming between islands, you know. However, something like the Northern Passage, I think, you know, I really want to promote that to the government and as maybe a sort of major trail that would promote cross-border tourism in Hong Kong.
One of the things about Hong Kong is most people, you mentioned that split of how much isn't urban, but I think a lot of people think that it's urban. So is that one of the biggest challenges?
Much of it is built up, but a lot of people don't really know the side of it that we know. And that perhaps limits kind of tourism in a way, right?
Certainly to those sort of areas, people wouldn't be your number one destination to really to go hiking or to go to a beach or to go to the countryside. And so, yeah, it benefits locals who know about it and know where to go. Yeah, that is true. I mean, in terms of like physicality, one of the reasons there is so much countryside is that there's a lot of steep slopes and a lot of water. And so therefore, there's not many areas relatively to build apartment blocks, to build residential, to build urban areas. And so that's one of the reasons why everything is very high density population, and also why the rental prices, the land, real estate is the highest in the world, because there's too many slopes to build apartments safely. And that means that a lot of the hiking is a lot of up and down. So that would be one thing that is a challenge to maybe your average hiker if you're not used to it. I think it's a good thing because of views, and also it means that if you're just doing flat hikes all the time, it doesn't get so challenging. But here, if you get to a reasonable level of fitness and you can hike up to the sort of the ridge line, then the whole of Hong Kong hiking and all the trails is open to you.
It's interesting the way the trails are kind of set in Hong Kong. And I actually did the West Highland Way a few years ago, and it was interesting because I was hiking the West Highland Way, and then you come to the mountain. And the West Highland Way would skirt the mountain, which is the kind of sensible approach to trail, right? It doesn't work like that in Hong Kong. The trails come to a mountain and it will take you straight up the mountain, and it won't even be switchbacks. It won't kind of zigzag up the mountain. It will be straight up and then straight down again. And that's it with Hong Kong. That's how it works. It challenges you so much. It's brutal. Every single trail in Hong Kong is brutal. And I remember, was it you, Jack, that was saying that your relatives were coming to Hong Kong and you asked me for a recommendation for a nice, easy, flat hike?
My wife.
I was like, I don't know, because there's nothing that's easy in Hong Kong, I would say. And that combined with the heat as well, you know, for most of the year in Hong Kong, you're 30 plus, I would say 8 months, you're going up and down, you're going up and down. It's very, very tough. And people die all the time in Hong Kong from heat stroke, because they go out and the physical exertion is extreme, the heat is extreme, the humidity is extreme, and people die. You know, going back to the Argyle Ross Trail, part of this trail was it's a trail you can do in the summer, because you're going to be wet the whole way. You're going to be jumping in the streams, you're going to be in the waterfalls, or you're going to be in the sea. So there's always that opportunity to cool down a bit. And I think that's what sets the Argyle Ross Trail from the rest of the trails in Hong Kong, is it's a summer trail, whereas a lot of the stuff in Hong Kong is really tough in the summer.
The streams on the trail are shaded as well, which makes a big difference. And there's a lot of fresh water supply all the time, so you're never going to get thirsty at all.
Have you had a lot of people already done the trail?
Well, that's a great question. We don't know. We would say that there's been a fair few, definitely. But unless they contact us, we'll contact on the Instagram. It's really, and some people do send some photos in, which is great. It's hard to know.
We recced the trail over several months, and then we launched it March last year. And we'd never designed this trail for trail runners. You know, you're swimming half of it, right? It's like
the streams are slippery. The rocks are slippery.
It's
so
slow going.
You wouldn't go at anything more than a normal walking pace, really,
It's funny that there's a massive trail running community in Hong Kong. They're always looking for the next challenge. And all of a sudden, there was this kind of massive interest in the trail. As soon as we launched it, we weren't expecting it, but it was all the trail runners that were like, yeah, I'm going to do this. When are we going to do this? So there was this kind of initial race to finish this trail in one go, which we thought was impossible because it's so tough. 100K up and down streams, swimming islands. We didn't think it was possible. So we had a few attempts of trail runners trying to finish it, a lot of failures. And then there was one guy one day, he put it on Instagram, didn't he, Jack?
Kurt Lynn, yeah.
And he was a pilot in Hong Kong, and he was like, yeah, I'm going to give this a go. And he did it. It wasn't even particularly very good weather. It was raining quite a lot. He was the first one to do it in one go. He did it in 30 hours, no sleep.
He's climbing up waterfalls in the dark on his own at 1 or 2 in the morning.
And he went out. Did he not say that he went up the wrong waterfall as well? He got lost and went up the wrong waterfall. So he's basically climbing sort of cliffs that he's not meant to in the dark, you know, having had no sleep for about 20 hours.
Lots of variety within it.
Then. Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's the highlight. Is there's some tough hiking in there as well. You know, there's some overgrown trails. There's some ridge hikes. There's grasslands. There's sandy kind of deserty sort of environments. There's waterfalls. There's sea. There's beaches. There's all sorts. It's so varied. It's amazing.
I have done a little bit of hiking in Asia, but not been to Hong Kong. I did some walking in Singapore, which is only about 2/3 of the size of Hong Kong. Now that the borders are opening up with Hong Kong, it seems like it's a great place to experience the city and lots of trails at the same time. Although, as Jack and Stuart said, a lot of them are quite challenging. I don't mind hills, but I do like those switchbacks to get to the top. I do remember coming down from a pretty high peak in Austria once and deciding, stupidly, to go straight down instead of using the switchbacks. I think I passed Usain Bolt on the way down. I was literally shouting at people to move out of the way because I couldn't stop. Lesson learned. I planned on doing some filming of walks this week, what with it being the Easter break for schools, but of course the weather decided that I shouldn't. I definitely don't mind walking in the rain, but I'm not about to expose all the recording equipment to torrents of water. So it will have to be dry weekends, which are pretty rare. On the podcast next week, we'll be talking about a book launch, among other things. So we will be back next week, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of the WalkingPost.com podcast. And I hope you have a great week, hopefully with a walk, or even two. And until next time, happy trails. Walking Post from walkingpost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.